You're listening to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture.
The influence of my father's thinking on me is pretty considerable. So he was at the AA after the war with one of those second degrees available for demobbed servicemen. He had before the war, then he served, and then he went to the AA and did a lot of thinking about social architecture, had a mindset which I seem to have inherited. Yes, I'm proud to feel a bit of a chip off the old block, actually, and it was sad that he is often referred to as the best president that the RIBA never had.
Hello and welcome to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture, with me, Owen Wainhouse.
Hello, I'm Ben Derbyshire and I'm the president of the RIBA. We need to, you know, look hard in the mirror and ask ourselves, are we communicating with absolute clarity and actually with substantial evidence that we have a contribution to make? And my challenge to the profession and to academia is to say, I don't think we are.
Our guest this week is the 76th president of the Royal Institute of British Architects. Ben Derbyshire was elected by the Institute's 44,000-strong membership in August 2016 on a platform calling for change, both within the Institute and across the profession. After a year serving as president-elect, he succeeded Jane Duncan as president in September 2017. Ben's career in practice started in 1973 when he joined Hunt Thompson Associates as a year out student. After returning to university to complete his part two, he came back to the practice permanently in 1976 and has stayed ever since, rising to become managing director and now chair of the practice. The practice, now known as HTA Design, is perhaps best known for its award-winning housing, residential and urban regeneration work. For this week's episode, I joined Ben in the President's office at the RIBA's HQ on Portland Place. I started by suggesting to Ben, slightly tongue-in-cheek, that for a president elected on a platform for change, he's enjoyed remarkable stability in his career at HTA Design.
Yes, well, I'd say that is the only stable thing. I look back on a career when I joined what was then Hunt Thompson Associates as its fifth member in 1973 as a year out student. And I was only once close to leaving, and that was to join Ted Cullinan's practice. But that didn't happen. So stability, but only in the sense that I've belonged to one practice for my entire professional career and grown up with it. And of course, the transition from a practice of five to our current, we're nearly 200 now.
Wow.
Is a learning experience, a very helpful learning experience. And you know, the ins and outs of three recessions and the radical changes in information technology over that period of four decades certainly couldn't be described as stability.
No. You joined Hunter Thompson Associates permanently in 76, but there was a year out between Birmingham and Cambridge.
Yes, I went to Birmingham School of Architecture initially, principally because they had a live projects office,
right,
which then closed, sadly. And then I moved to, after my year out with Hunt Thompson, moved to Cambridge because I liked the idea of the freedom, particularly in the fifth year that was then possible. And in fact, I spent most of my fifth year studying in London in and around Spitalfields. So it was a fascinating time.
But not The school was in Dorset. Is that right?
Well, my academic career is slightly checkered, actually. So I spent some time in Dorset and some time not.
Okay.
best to leave that.
Right. Okay. So, but where's the family home? Where are you originally from the south-west?
I'm a Yorkshireman. I'm from Leeds.
Right. Okay.
And we came south when my father, who died 2 years ago, got a job with Sturrock Johnson Marshall to design York University.
An architect in the family.
Yeah.
That was what led you into architecture, really, was it?
Well, I have that advantage, which unfortunately so many young people these days don't have. In fact, for me, the question was, should I look elsewhere? Because it was too clearly available to me to understand what the role of an architect was. But actually, the influence of my father's thinking on me is pretty considerable. So he was at the AA after the war with one of those second degrees that were available for demobbed servicemen. He had a physics degree from Cambridge before the war, then he served, and then after the war he went to the AA and did a lot of thinking about collaboration, about social architecture, and in particular about prefabrication. So he had a mindset which I seem to have inherited.
almost in its entirety. I mean, with thoughts about kind of some of the social architecture and about our kind of off-site construction.
Yes, I'm proud to feel a bit of a chip off the old block, actually. And it was sad that he is often referred to as the best president the RIBA never had. And he did know shortly before he died that I was going to run for the office, but and sadly he never quite made it to the moment when I won the election.
So work he was doing was, and you talked about York University.
Yes.
Was there much kind of, you're obviously known through the practice for housing, for your work. Did housing feature much in his other kind of architectural work?
Not really. With John Volcker and others, he did a pretty crazy scheme, which is actually in the RIBA collection, for a new town. But he never worked on housing at any scale. But I was at York with my sister quite recently. We were scouting a location for a memorial stone, which we're having erected to him, where we'll sprinkle his ashes. And the original concept of York University, economical prefabricated buildings in a beautiful landscape setting, is absolutely vitally in existence, and there are some, it was a rather dreary January day, but I took some stunning photographs, really, which absolutely reflect the images evoked in the 1960s design work that my father did in the campus at York. Unfortunately, the approaches to it, and he was very sad in his declining years that the master plan wasn't being adhered to, and actually there's now a very big problem that from every direction you approach through sprawling car parks, and so they've kind of blown it, sadly. But once you get into it,
in amongst the original
heart of the campus, it's very beautiful.
Right. So Birmingham, have no doubt then about doing architecture onto Birmingham University. Three years there.
Yeah, I absolutely loved it.
Right.
I had a great time. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I did.
That's interesting. You speak to a lot of people who, I guess, have gone through questions about whether they're going to go into architecture and whether they've, but you just settled straight into the degree.
Adored it. And I'm from the very beginning, I was making. I liked.
Right.
And so I'm a big believer in making. Models. And we had, Tony Seeley, I don't know if he's still alive, but ran a great workshop, and you know, we were all encouraged to make, and we did. It was great fun.
And then at Cambridge, you met then. Did you study with Bernard Hunt and John
No,
Thompson?
No, he was there before me. So they're Hunt and Thompson are actually about a decade my senior, and they've both retired now. And Bernard was the last to leave the practice about 6 years ago. So no, I didn't know them then, but I was scouting for a good place to work in my year out, and somebody, they'd actually done their year out at Robert Matthew Johnson Marshall and Partners, and so somebody who was a friend of my father said, "You go and work for those two young guys there. They've got what it takes." Yeah. So I did, and then didn't regret it.
And they were both, I mean, housing was there. Real interest.
Yes, in those days they were doing, you know, one-off houses and conversions and in and around Camden Town.
Right, okay. So working from Cambridge but working in London.
Well, they started their practice while they were at Cambridge.
Right,
but then they bought a shop front in Parkway.
Wow, okay.
Where we practiced in the early days.
So five people when you joined in doing your year out.
Yeah.
After Cambridge joined, they were obviously happy to have you back.
Yes.
Joined as a permanent member of staff.
Yes.
Do you remember any of the kind of projects you were working on then? I mean, what was the sort of?
Well, it was a fun time. So the partners were Bernard Hunt, John Thompson, and Edward Bird, who's also retired. We're getting them all together to celebrate HTA's 50th. Actually, wow. This March, hopefully, for a lunch. And also Prince Richard of Gloucester, now the Duke of Gloucester, who was a partner. And it was he and I used to go and do the survey work in, you know, Knightsbridge Muses and stuff. So we were the you know, on the front line and the kind of junior members of the partnership at that time.
And he's the only member, I guess, of the royal family with that architectural background. How long did he stay in the practice?
Well, he had to leave when his brother, the original title holder, the Duke of Gloucester, had an aeroplane crash and was killed. So then Richard had to take up those royal duties.
Of office.
So he had to retire from the practice at that point.
Wow, brush with royalty.
Yes. And, well, actually, my first brush with, because then we later found ourselves working for the Duchy of Cornwall and Prince Charles, who had, as you know, an abiding interest in community architecture, which was what we called it then.
Yeah. We might come on to some of that. There's a history, certainly with the ROBA and Prince Charles, later on. So you moved then, I guess the practice kind of evolved from single kind of residential work to bigger resi schemes. I mean, now a lot of the practice's work is on much larger housing schemes. Was it a slow transition? What was the kind of?
No, it was sudden, and it was because we got a commission from Hackney Council to do the refurbishment of an estate called Lee View. Oh. And having had a background in single home conversions and new builds of one sort or another, we wrestled with the idea of how to establish the needs and aspirations of a large population of people occupying a mass housing estate. And so Bernard Hunt hit upon the idea of deploying his wife's skills as a social researcher. And in fact, we set up a subsidiary company called User Research, Urban Social and Environmental Research, which ran alongside Hunt Thompson for, I don't know, probably 20 years, maybe less, 15 years. And so we had a social research subsidiary, and Lee View House was the first occasion when we used social research as a tool to understand the way that residents saw the problems of the dilapidated accommodation. And the dramatic outcome of that for us was that the confidence that information gave us resulted in a more dramatic, a quite radical transformation of Leeview House in a way that was demonstrably supported by residents. So, I mean, in all the subsequent years and in relation to the current debate about urban regeneration, it has always been our view that it is absolutely essential to obtain demonstrable evidence of the support for by the residents for the nature of the intervention that's proposed. That's always been sine qua non for us. And, you know, I actually think that in recent years, some clients have forgotten that necessity. And frankly, we've had some trouble persuading some clients in urban regeneration of the importance of it.
I mean, maybe just say a few words then about the kind of, I mean, people talk now about consultation and about kind of the kind of process architects go through, but what is that kind of user, that what is that social research? How
does that well, we unfortunately, we closed down user research when the big social research companies cottoned on to this market and they undercut us massively and there was no way that we could compete with them. So by the time it became much more routine to obtain opinion research as part of a regeneration process, we were being undercut by Mori and the other big outfits. However, you know, it became and still is part of the DNA of the practice and the way we think. And so I'm very pleased to see the mayor's guidance on estate regeneration, and we're delighted to see that, you know, it includes something we always argue for, which is a residence charter. And we always say to our clients, look, you're not going to be able to get residents to engage with questions of design, layout, options, phasing, any of those crucially important things to make decisions about until you've satisfied them as to the basic terms of their ongoing accommodation. You know, what are their rights to new accommodation? What rent will they pay? You know, what will be the terms of their tenancy and so on? You know, and actually, of course, also there are homeowners too. So, you know, I suppose until, you know, the recent controversies about this, it had become more and more difficult to persuade clients to do more than basically PR, trying to persuade people that it's a good scheme and they should accept it. No, but so it really has to come from, you know, within a tenant population in order to be sure of success. And you know, rather a good arrangement in the past was with the stock transfer schemes where, you know, a ballot was a prerequisite. You know, you had to have a ballot and it would be run by the Electoral Reform Society and done, you know, thoroughly and properly. And
is that, I mean, taught then through? I mean, I haven't been through architecture school. I mean, is that a thing that strikes me as something that maybe you kind of teach design and you teach critical thinking and creativity in architecture school? But the opinion research would seem to be a kind of, I mean, it's the thing you see politicians doing, knocking on doors and looking at engagement. Was that ever taught through Cambridge, or is that something that you...
No, well, it was my abiding interest.
Right.
And the reason for going to Birmingham was because they had a live projects office. Right. And the reason for going to Cambridge was that it enabled me in my fifth year to spend more or less the entire time in and around Spitalfields trying to figure out... I mean, I'm not making a claim that I succeeded particularly. I mean, I look at my fifth year thesis these days, and it's fairly toe curling. But but the interest was in resolving those questions that people are still interested in now. Right. How do you resolve what start out being conflicts between the nature of the accommodation, the economic forces, and the needs and aspirations of local communities to maintain a foothold in the places they've come to enjoy as places to live.
And that maybe then that kind of early interest in perhaps slightly wider issues than pure architecture, you know, starting to get into politics a little bit and starting to then think about wider issues for the profession. Just sort of getting into some of the wider issues, I guess you're focusing on a little bit more full time now at the RIBA in terms of role of the profession and the engagement of government and more societal issues, maybe.
Yeah, I think a couple of thoughts about that. First of all, the theme of my presidency is quality and performance in the built environment. And when I speak about quality, I like always to explain that I'm not simply talking about aesthetic quality. I'm talking about outcomes. And I'm talking about outcomes that affect the well-being of the people who use the environments that we design. So that's my understanding and my commitment. And I think the infrastructure and the context for the profession needs to recognize that understanding much more thoroughly. And there are lots of things that I'm trying to do about post-occupancy evaluation, about the prediction of performance, and so on, which matter to me, and I think will improve the fortunes of the profession, but perhaps we'll come on to that later. But as to politics, I mean, I'm doing a tour of schools at the moment. I really enjoy it very much. My campaign strapline was hashtag change is necessary, as you probably know. And I stand up in front of audiences of students. I was at the Bartlett just this week, and I shall be in Plymouth next week. And I stand up and I say, you know, I'm not going to show you any pictures, because I'm sure lots of people come and show you pictures. Yeah. I'm going to talk to you about the politics of architecture and its future. Yeah. And the relationship between our profession and society, and how we can restore value and respect to a level which I think will benefit society, because I believe in the contribution that architects can make through our work, and will benefit society through an improved and more sustainable built environment.
And what's the reaction from students? I mean, is that something they're expecting? Is that the kind of, is there a...
Well, I haven't been booed out of the hall yet. No, you'll have to speak to them.
I mean,
whatever the reaction is, I think it's important to say, you know, to say it how it is, and that is how it is in my view. I told them that the question of the role of the professions in society generally is more or less facing an existential threat, and that we, as professions, and I'm not just talking about architecture here, I'm talking about all the professions, need to understand the immense implications of the rapidly changing context in which we work, the impact of artificial intelligence, the competition from people who are providing design, businesses that are providing design for free because advances in information technology enable them to do so, loft conversions, kitchen designs, manufactured housing, you know, every which way you look, there is disruptive change, and we just can't afford to go on what I think was essentially a class-based model, whereby, you know, the respect of the masses was earned through an elite in society who were those who could afford a professional education. I mean, happily, that is a total anachronism, and a thing of the past, but we need to replace it with something pretty convincing in order to influence society in the built environment in the way that we would wish.
Almost terrifying, maybe. You think about the kind of change from, I mean, at the beginning of your career, I mean, I guess hand drawing and, you know, principally before, you know, certainly before BIM and before, you know, how much the profession has changed in those few years.
I mean, it's, you know, it is pretty dramatic. I wasn't quite on a high stool with a quill pen, but I was on a parallel motion drawing board with a repeater graph.
Yeah. Wow.
And stencils for the labelling.
Yeah.
and razor blades for scratching out mistakes. Unbelievable. But that's where I started my career.
Yeah. And so there is maybe slightly joke about that. How much the industry has changed over those years. It takes a lot of, sure really, not sure what the question is, but just...
Well, I can make an observation on your demo yeah. question. My observation is that the atmosphere of the practice has always been to seek out change
yeah.
and to be curious. And in fact, you know, we have a helpfully alliterative series of brand behaviours yeah. that in HTA designers is now,
yeah. Yeah.
And curiosity is one of them. You know, we believe that you have to invest in inquiry, and the inquiry needs to be about the context for your practice that doesn't yet exist,
yeah.
And that's how you know you can anticipate change and enjoy it rather than feel threatened by it. That's my view. And I, you know, it's so interesting to be at the RIBA now.
you beat me to the question.
Well, it stood me in good stead in practice. And in preparation for the post of presidency, I talked to lots of people. One of them was Paul Finch.
Yeah.
He said, "Oh, just run it like you run your practice, Ben." Yeah.
And is that, I mean, so you're, what is it, 6 months, 7 months, 8 months yeah. into the 2 year term?
Yeah.
In what, 180 year history, 76th president? I'm just wondering about how quickly you can kind of instill change. It always strikes me a little bit that the RIBA is perhaps, with an incoming president, a little bit like maybe a government ministry in terms of yeah. having a minister coming in and.
Yeah.
The civil service somehow manages to avoid change, maybe by ministers changing too quickly. I mean, is a two-year term long enough?
Well, just to pick up on my last comment, you know, obviously I don't run the RIBA, so sorry,
right.
Paul.
Right.
it would be a benign dictatorship, yeah. perhaps, but that is a fantasy. I work with a big team.
Yeah.
And the great thing for me is the window of opportunity that I see opening up for me here.
Yeah.
Firstly, because Jane Duncan, my predecessor, made it possible for us to select a new chief executive and chief financial officer. And so we are now building a completely new senior executive team. And I work very closely with them and the senior members who are involved in the governance of the Institute, and in a very enjoyable way. It's not always a smooth ride, but we work together on change. So that's the first point. You know, I think it's systemic. And, you know, the organization, and it's quite complicated in a membership organization yeah. with charitable status. It's not like running a practice.
Yeah.
In that sense. But on the other hand, there are ways in which I see the practice of architecture and, you know, its social impact, which I've been able, it's ways of seeing
yeah.
that I've been able to bring to the RIBA and I hope bring to my role here, so that the executive team, who of course not architects, are enabled by that vision. To see how we need to change, and they're an incredibly able team, and I'm happy and proud to be working with them. As to the 2 years, of course not, And people said to me, "Well, just concentrate on one thing, Ben. You've got, your agenda is much too wide," and of course I acknowledge that. But I'm not particularly interested in my personal legacy. That's not what it's all about. What I'm convinced of is that. With other professions, we've been in a spiraling decline of trust and respect of our position in society, particularly since the Second World War. The second half of the 20th century has seen a very substantial challenge there. And, I'm putting my shoulder to the wheel of turning that into an ascending spiral, if at all possible. And I believe it is possible. But it's only going to be possible if we assemble, we research collaboratively to assemble a body of knowledge which is valued by society, which society sees the purpose of, and then we equip our members, the members of our profession, with that knowledge, you know, in order to make the case that architecture is politically purposeful in achieving what society wants. And there's no question in my mind, you hear it all the time, you know, society is dissatisfied with the quality of the built environment. You hear it all the time. And of course, it's a kind of incoherent cry that one hears. You know, they're dissatisfied with it because it doesn't look like it was built in the 18th century in some parts of society. They're dissatisfied with it because they've bought a home and it's full of defects. Or they're dissatisfied with it because they already live in a home and they don't want new neighbours in new accommodation. There are all of these manifestations of dissatisfaction. So surely to goodness, the 1% of the student cohort who are specifically trained to deliver in this area, architects, you know, ought to be more engaged in solving that social problem, that political problem that the built environment does not satisfy the people who live in it, by and large.
Yeah. I'm interested then in kind of how normal people, you might say, people who aren't architects, never really have any training in how to live in a space. So you often...
Can I challenge that? First of all, yeah. You use a phrase, normal people.
I'm people, yeah.
Something that's really important to me is, so one hears the language used by some professionals and some academics and some successful students in academia. And it's a language which is incredibly hard to understand.
Yeah.
I sit there and I listen to descriptions of prize-winning dissertations, and I strain. You know, I've been around for quite a long time in the built environment, you know, reading widely. I don't regard myself as a Philistine. Others may, but I don't. And, you know, this idea that somehow or other society is at fault for not understanding, we need to, you know, look hard in the mirror and ask ourselves, are we communicating with absolute clarity and actually with substantial evidence and that we have a contribution to make? And my challenge to the profession and to academia is to say, I don't think we are.
Often hearing people talk and think, I don't know what that means. Yeah, I don't know how you translate that. But I guess kind of coming back a bit then, people who haven't undergone an architectural training often don't have a language with which to describe the problems they have with their building or do you think that's true in terms of...
No, I mean, I have to say this is a complete dead end.
Right.
Just don't go there. Okay. You know, people fly in aeroplanes.
Yeah.
And, you know, the designers of the aeroplanes and the airlines that fly them have absolutely no difficulty in the essential relationship with their consumers.
Yeah.
And they communicate in that relationship, you know, and right down to the incredibly sophisticated technologies that create a Boeing Dreamliner. You know, you do not do that by being obscure.
And then in terms of kind of changing how people communicate and how architects, you know, the kind of language that architects use, where does that slightly opaque language come from, do you think? Is that through architecture schools? Is it by being around other architects and in a sense kind of feeding off other people's language and becoming more technical maybe?
Well, I don't actually, let's talk about this issue in the context of the professions at large rather than just... architects. And so the class-based exclusivity is one which I think our society with aspirations to greater fairness is simply not going to put up with. And quite right too. So I'm not talking about dumbing down the intellectual sophistication of our task because, you know, it's actually becoming much more complicated. Yeah. But I am talking about being completely clear in the way we communicate and not use impenetrable jargon, which you're right, I suspect, is often deployed to impress peers with the sophistication of your understanding, rather than to communicate with your a public audience.
Diversity is obviously an issue within the profession, changing maybe a bit within the RIBA, certainly the RIBA staff, as diverse as London. Membership changing slowly?
The issue of diversity, you know, continues to be an incredibly important challenge, and I worry a lot, particularly about the cost of education. But the cost of education, and I'm never challenged when I deploy the statistic that it's typically 10 years between starting at college and becoming a member of the RIBA. And if you don't have a family to support you financially, £100,000 of student debt. Now, that is a very considerable disincentive to people who then look at typical remuneration and or look to creating a family. And for me, therein lies the reason for the statistics. And when it comes to Black British students, 8% of the cohort at year one dwindles to 1% of the cohort at part three. That's deeply troubling. And I'm sure that part of it is the equation that people think through about, you know, the value that they'll regain for the effort, the deployment of time and resource and the borrowing that is entailed to achieve it. So that's a major problem. But also I worry a lot about practice and the way that you know, we work. And I think one of the things I'd like to try to do and start and train is higher expectations, especially through our system of chartered practices, who are RIBA members who buy into doing more than just deliver on our code of conduct. Chartered practices at the moment have to sign up to report their equality, diversity and inclusion policies. They need to commit not to pay interns less than the minimum wage and so on. I think we need to do more. And I think we should have an expectation of family-friendly practice, which is much more profound. And I think the existence of machismo in the profession is quite a problem. So a disproportionate number of us, especially at senior level, are men. And we are predisposed or we habitually use masculine behavior, you know, in order to achieve, as we see it, better outcomes. That's a fallacy and it's counterproductive in my view. So I don't think, you know, working all night and precisely. I mean, this is something we've got, and it's partly societal, of course. But I think we need to play our part in reversing those trends. And until we do, we won't see an improvement in what are pretty depressing statistics. And we must see that improvement because we must be a diverse profession, in my view, in order to deliver on the hopes and reasonable expectations of a diverse population that we serve.
And then maybe coming on sort of slightly more onto housing, one of your... Was it at the last year's big debate, the NLA's debate, your announcement of a housing expo?
I didn't announce it. So what happened, this was this time last year, and Peter Murray and New London Architecture filled, impressively, the Friends Meeting House on Euston Road with 1,000...
The John McCaslin
It was a terrific event, yeah. Actually. And the challenge was for panelists to sit alongside members of the GLA's political establishment, and I was on the panel with James Murray, the deputy chair for housing. We were briefed to challenge them with policy ideas that they hadn't already deployed, and my proposition was that the NIMBY problem in London has got to be addressed because because the GLA concludes that, you know, London will supply its requirement for 66,000 new homes a year from entirely within its existing boundaries. And that means we've got to build cheek by jowl. And if we're going to build cheek by jowl, we've got to do so in a way which is not only acceptable, but is desirable so far as existing members of communities who will be acquiring new neighbours are concerned. And, you know, this is a point, as we know, of very considerable debate, both, you know, amongst the political class, but actually at local level, you know. Quite usual to have on what you would think would be a perfectly benign addition to a neighbourhood of low-cost social housing, hundreds of objections is typical. So my proposition was to have an expo, to make the expo an effort directed at a public audience, and to say, look, it's in your interest to create, and the paraphrase then was desirable density, that, you know, you can intensify your neighbourhood in such a way as to generate benefits, not disadvantages to you. So there might be, well, more affordable homes for your family and your children, when we're grievously failing on that objective. But there are many more too. There are points about better access to employment, better access to services, better services because greater population density, you know, enables more post offices, cash points, doctor's surgeries, and so on. So an improved infrastructure is driven by an increase in population density, and of course that issue is always expressed the other way round, so far as the objectives are concerned. Don't build because there isn't the infrastructure. Well, obviously the answer to this is to invest in infrastructure and see the provision of housing as part of that. Yeah. So the idea was to have a citywide expo. Mm-hmm. And Peter Murray and I are making pretty good progress on that, and we hope to have news on it soon.
Right. And the idea, I mean, I guess, you know, one of the problems London has is a huge, it's hard to know whether it's a desire for Londoners to live in terraced housing or whether the terraced housing, which is relatively low density or kind of that slightly suburban, maybe not terraced housing, but certainly semis as a kind of urban sprawl maybe, whether that's what people want to live in with the idea of a garden and a space for the car, or whether that's the only thing they can buy because that's the only thing that's been built. Is the expo partly designed to get people thinking about other options?
Yes, absolutely it is.
And I guess a lot of European cities then have got that density somewhat higher, you know, building kind of mansion block size.
Yes.
And fairly, to get rid of probably much more compact city, you know, easy to get around. Kind of interested in that sort of international influence, really, that bulk of your work has been at HDA, has been in the UK.
Yeah, it has, yeah.
You know, and is that, you've obviously now got the office in Manchester, office in Edinburgh. You've done a little bit of work, I saw on a few projects in China, a few around the world, but the bulk here, I'm just kind of interested in whether that's by design, whether that's just you've got enough work here, that other people have maybe worked overseas because they've been chasing the work, or whether...
Well... Pretty complicated question. I think I'll start from the point of view of the RIBA. I think what is exciting for us as a profession to consider is the global reach of the brand of the Royal Institute of British Architects. Mm-hmm. You know, there's quite a lot of discussion in the UK about how well we do our job, whether we communicate enough, whether we provide adequate services for the value of the fee, you know, and one could easily get the impression that the whole thing isn't working. Yeah. People should understand, and when one travels abroad on behalf of the RIBA, we have an immense opportunity, and the significance of that as we approach Brexit, assuming we do, is very considerable. So when I talk about the profession's contribution to creating a sustainable, attractive and enjoyable built environment which delivers well-being to citizens, you know, clearly that is incredibly significant, not just here. And I'm not pretending that we're doing it well here. You know, housing in London is unaffordable for most people, which is appalling. But the urbanisation of cities and developing countries is something where we have a contribution to make. So, and you know, there is a crying need for expertise. So I personally think, and the Institute is increasingly investing in how we can contribute to the global challenge of urbanisation and sustainable. High quality accommodation. It's UN Development Goal number 11, and it's a pan global challenge because we fail on it here to provide high quality affordable accommodation for all our citizens. We fail on it here, and other countries are failing on it too. So we need to collaborate globally as a profession to solve it. So I'm really enthusiastic about that. I mean, as to our ventures at HTA, we've tried in China, we've tried in India. Yeah. It's quite difficult, and I think the Institute has a real role in assisting practices to gain access to markets, support them, and so on.
Just wondering, kind of thinking aloud, really, whether that's partly that housing is perhaps the most kind of culturally difficult overseas, where a lot of the certainly the architect names have been commissioned, I guess, for big cultural projects or big arenas and sports halls and commercial buildings, rather than housing, maybe, and whether housing is so tied into kind of national identity and how people want to live. Maybe.
Well, I suppose it has been. But again, it's the nature of change. And there are factories springing up all over the UK now making housing.
Yeah.
And I regard this, again, as an opportunity for the profession. I've talked for years about the way the profession needs to understand the benefits of being a designer in industry. And the great innovators in design in the past have often been people who have been absolutely part of the industrial complex, spent their lives with an understanding of the means of production. And I think there's a huge opportunity there. So I, of course, there's an argument that locally sourced materials and barefoot architecture is the answer, and possibly in some locations that might be true. But I think the way in which we now can envisage that factory-made housing needn't be serried rows of porter cabins, with complete disregard of sense of place. I mean, mass customization and the sophistication of digital printing mean that need no longer be the case. So I think there is a huge opportunity for technological sophistication to meet the needs of the global population. Yeah.
That's really, we were doing some of these podcasts with the British Council in Kenya last month, and talking about where people get their influences from. And we're increasingly saying that architecture students in Kenya now, rather than, a lot of the buildings certainly in Nairobi are from colonial periods. And so what do modern younger Kenyan architects have as their kind of reference? Increasingly, they're saying a lot of the references they get now are global in terms of the buildings that they see on Dazeen or wherever, and making that quite hard as a local Kenyan architect to get people to think about what's a kind of a Kenyan vernacular. And so it's just interesting that almost that kind of globalization of architectural education a little bit. That
I think there's a danger in the seductive glamour of the the well-shot blue sky image, populating the pages of glossy magazines and becoming the reference point for people's aspirations. That, for me, is the wrong way to look at it. We need to get under the skin of the problem, think about the outcomes, and then, you know, critical thinking, creativity, and design talent married to the development of appropriate technologies gets you to the place where you have a successful solution. You don't have a successful solution, in my view, if your starting point is referencing the work of a distant, glamorous star-architect who you want to emulate. That is the wrong way to look at it.
Yeah. So I would start to round up in a second. It's kind of interested then just on housing, how you choose to live in London. I mean, so you're Brompton in the corner, you're kind of keen, I guess, as you move around the city, but are you in an apartment? What's your kind of...
First of all, the transportation options. Apart from rain, which is a problem, especially in the mornings, and when doesn't really want to turn up as the president of the RIBA looking like a drowned rat, I have to say my preferred mode of transport around London is definitely the Brompton. It's such a great city to travel around by bicycle, and people talk about being fearful of the traffic, and I've been riding a bike in London since I first arrived here in 1973. I've been knocked off twice in that period of time, minor injuries. I'm not fearless, but it's absolutely a delightful way of moving around. And actually, on a personal note, it's my only form of exercise. Yeah. I used to swim, but I don't even do that now. I'm too busy. Yeah. And so I kill two birds with one stone. As to accommodation, well, the thing is about architects, we don't, most of us earn vast amounts of money, but we are quite adept at acquiring space by moving to places where people don't terribly want to live. And so over many years, I've left a trail of space behind me, and we've solved the accommodation problem for my current wife and I. We have five children between us simply by dividing up the space differently. And so we don't live together, but we live collectively, and that's very enjoyable. And so the buildings are not particularly glamorous, but they work for us as a family, yeah.
And then finally, we're talking about kind of housing expos and people looking at experiencing interesting housing. Apart from your own work, are there things you think people should be, developments in London you think are particularly impressive or novel that people should be on their trips around London, should be looking at or thinking about, or new models?
I'm going to reserve the answer to that question. If and when we get Weaving with the Expo, we'll begin with some digital resource, an app possibly, or a website. And I tweeted yesterday that item one on the historical element of that would be the Prince Regent's model housing, which is now in Lambeth. Right. There have been a long history of innovation in London, and I think we need to get back on the front foot with a more ambitious range of choices for Londoners than is currently available, and that will be the kind of excitement we hope to generate. So I'm going to dodge that question and ask you to watch this space.
Okay, well, we'll come back later on and ask you. That's great. Thank you so much for your time, giving up so generously your time. That's a real insight into your influences and your
thank you very much. I've enjoyed it. Thanks.
Been listening to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture. On the programme this week was Ben Derbyshire. You can find out more about Ben and his work at architecturemasters.org, from where you can also subscribe to the podcast and follow us on Twitter. You can send any comments, questions or suggestions by email to hello@architecturemasters.org. If you've enjoyed the programme, why not leave a review with your podcast provider, as this helps others to find the programme. You've been listening to the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture. I'm Owen Wainhouse. Thank you for listening.